Welcome to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, hosted by Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements of Drab to Fab Landscaping. Garden Talk aims to introduce new ideas to help solve problems and keep you up to date on the latest development in the nursery and landscape industry. For a podcast of today's program and others, visit walteranderson.com and click on the podcast tab. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, San Diego. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Kane Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements, and we will be here for the next hour talking to you about all kinds of stuff going on in your yard and garden. If you have a question for us, would like to comment on the show, or have a suggestion for a topic or a guest you would like to hear about, you can email us at gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com or follow us on the Walter Anderson Nursery main Facebook page. We do have a class today in Poway. It's common tree pests and treatments with Pedro Berry, a local certified arborist.
Who was on the radio show a while back.
Yep. Pedro's a good guy. Knows his stuff.
Yeah, he does.
He taught a class here before, which was very well received. So
yeah, I believe there is a class in San Diego, but unfortunately I don't have that class today. But if you give the store a call, they would be happy to tell you what it is. Their class starts at 9 o'clock. Ours start at 9:30. So,
because we like to sleep late in Poway.
Well, it's the country. We're up feeding the chickens and milking the cows.
We have to take care of the farm first.
We got other stuff to do. I didn't know that they did this, but they award the pollinator plant of the year.
Is it like an Academy Award?
I guess. But and the 2025 pollinator plant of the year this year, lemon bee balm.
What's the criteria in which they rate?
Yeah. Well, it got 336 votes. So,
and if Lemon Bee Balm is unable to carry out her duties, then we will have...
accepting the award.
Accolade for- Variety Moonshine is second runner-up. So,
yeah. It says it won by a healthy 58% margin over...
Who was first runner-up?
Blue Curls. Phacelia congesta. Is that woolly blue curls?
No, Phacelia is different than woolly blue curls.
Phacelia congesta came in second.
You can always hear it breathe. It's kind of the congesta is this.
Those
natives.
So anyway, if you're looking for the pollinator of the year. It's pollinator plant of the year, Monarda citradora or lemon bee balm is what you want to plant. And it looks like they did that in San Antonio.
Wow.
Oh, you know what? I wonder, I bet you I got that article from the Texas Butterfly Ranch.
Oh, I bet you.
I bet that's where that came from. So
San Antonio.
Yeah. So yeah. Isn't that the home of paste picante?
It is paste picante sauce. It's New York City.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and as I mentioned, the Texas Butterfly Ranch, they have a fantastic website. So if you're looking for information, a lot of it is geared towards monarchs. But if you're looking for information on monarchs, that's a great level-headed resource to check out.
And if you listened to our podcast last week, you hear a little bit about the monarchs and that particular website and information you can find about the decline or the rise, depending on one's perspective.
Yeah, we had both, I think.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we have a special guest with us today. Renee Murphy is here. I first met her when she was working for our native plant supplier, Moosa Creek Nursery. And she's here to talk about some natives and some other things that she has been working on recently. Renee, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming in. It's a lot easier doing it this way than it is in getting up and getting to the station at 6 o'clock in the morning.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, we do too. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
My name is Renee Murphy. I'd say, I think my claim to fame is my really big career change that I made. Spent most of my life actually working in the fashion industry. Owned my own company and was flying back and forth to New York every month. And I was sort of living that childhood fashion dream. But around the time I moved into my 40s, I really kind of had a midlife crisis and realized this was not the journey for me anymore. And found myself anxious and just this feeling in the pit of my stomach. I was doing the wrong thing. I had a teenage daughter. I felt like I was teaching her all the wrong things, how to overconsume, how to spend way too much money, and really what wasn't really that important for your wedding day. I was in the luxury bridal market. Hmm. And I took a selfie of myself in the mirror. And I looked very different back then. I had that very fashion look to me, and I looked so depressed in the mirror. And I said, if I come back next year, I don't know what I'll do. And I walked away. And it was scary, and I really didn't know what I was going to do. But I thought to myself, what do I really love? What could I do to inspire whatever my next journey was going to be? And I just loved being out in nature. And I had started hiking a lot the years before and felt this peace when I was outside and just surrounded by nature. And it was so contradictory to the city life I was living. So I started taking horticulture classes over at Saddleback in Mission Viejo, which is a really awesome horticulture school, if you ever want to take courses.
And commute.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a commute here for San Diego. And as I was taking the classes, and I had an urban farming class and digging potatoes up out of the ground, my heart was just singing. Every day I was so happy. And my fashion friends would see pictures of me on social media and they said, girl, what are you doing? But you look happy. So I kept doing it. And I happened to be in Houston, and I decided to take a spontaneous tourist visit to see NASA. And they talked about trying to grow plants on Mars, but the soil's toxic. But plants have this ability to phytoremediate, which just means that plants can uptake and break down contaminants. And something hit me like a thunderbolt. And I said, well, why can't we do that here on Earth? And I said, I want to go back to school and be a scientist. So it was literally that decision in my mind that made me come back and figure out how I could go to school to go from business to science. And went back to Cal Poly Pomona and got my master's in plant science. Now, I didn't know what that meant. I thought it meant I was going to take some more advanced courses, and that's what it was. But no, start researching and you start reading publications. And the first time I read a publication, I broke down crying. I thought, what am I doing here? I'm too old for this. Can you do this? Can you change careers so late in life? And I did. Ended up having the best time of my life. I learned to drive tractors, lay irrigation, doing all the things I would need to do for research. And I graduated during COVID 2020. So it was a bit anticlimactic, but got a fantastic job as the sales director who also wanted somebody with plant knowledge at Moosa Creek Nursery. They had changed owners and wanted to grow the business, and it was the first stepping stone to this new career of mine. Relocated for the job out to the country, which I loved even more. Absolutely loved it. And I got a call from the Master Gardeners, and they said, we need somebody who can teach a Zoom class or talk to our team. And do you know someone who will do that? And I looked around the office and I realized that person was me, and I was terrified. And that's how I knew it was right. And I said, yes, me. And I taught my first class, and the feedback that came back from people, like, for them to understand the importance of natives and how good that was for the environment. And I was learning more and more about what was right for the environment. And I knew that was my direction. And I continued to teach the classes, had my first opportunity here at Walter Anderson's.
That's right. We were your stepping stone to that.
You
taught our first class, and that was very, very well received.
It was. Yeah. And the feedback that I got, ironically, I met this lovely young Girl Scout named Maya at that class. And she came in just wanting to hear about water-wise plants, but left being a native fan. And she started emailing me and asking me for more information. And, you know, we corresponded back and forth, but she really was the inspiration that made me know what I was supposed to be doing. And that was educating about the environment. Flash forward, again, because of my marketing background with fashion, I always post what I'm doing with the plants. Ironically, somebody I went to high school with who had worked with NASA for sending plants into space, he calls me from the nursery and says, Renee, we went to high school together and we seem to be in the same industry, as I was doing some research with an indigenous tribe growing desert plants out in the Salton Sea. And he said, tell me about what you're doing. And he worked for this phytoremediation firm using endophytes to help.
Back up. What's phytoremediation?
Okay, so phytoremediation, again, it's this plants that have this ability to be able to degrade contamination within the soil or throughout the plant or uptake it in the plant. Again, there's different ways in which a plant does this. But what we do is we inoculate, which is just, if you could imagine taking a backpack sprayer and spraying an inoculant onto a tree trunk. These plant microbes go into the tree and give them sort of a boost to be able to degrade contamination faster. One of the common problems with phytoremediation on contaminated sites is they get phytotoxicity, mm-hmm. which just means plant toxicity. With these inoculants, the plants are able to thrive in a contaminated space and additionally break down contamination faster. So this is new technology in the field. There aren't many sustainable and green ways to deal with contamination, but this is basically harnessing nature to clean contamination. And it took about 7 months from graduation to go from the original inspiration into this company in the Bay Area, which I relocated for. And at that point, my career just took off because of Walter Anderson's giving me those original opportunities that then connected me with the California Native Plant Society. And then they wanted me teaching. And before you knew it, I was teaching statewide, regionally, but then statewide. And the opportunities just kept stepping on top of each other into the Bay Area as a scientist. But because of my native plant background, my team really liked that. We were able to really expand that. We weren't just cleaning, but we were also helping to regenerate and restore. And so now we're doing restoration jobs with native plants in areas that are suspected of contamination, but not quite sure, or maybe the soil is very sodic. We're able to really give plants this extra boost to help even just get restoration sites up and off the ground, better establishment rates. So somehow I was marrying all the things that I loved all into one space. And I think because I stepped into where I was supposed to be, the universe responded.
We need to take a quick break, Renee, absolutely. But we're going to be back with more. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ, and our special guest, Renee Murphy. We'll be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements and our special guest, Renee Murphy. And we were talking about phytoremediation, I believe, was what we were discussing as we left.
Absolutely.
And it's where, back up just sure. a bit and we'll start that. We'll continue that conversation.
So phytoremediation is just a plant's ability to be able to uptake or break down contaminants in water and soil. Mm-hmm. So we use this technology to try and re-educate and inspire environmental consultants to use this as a technology versus very carbon-heavy, expensive methods of cleaning up contamination that don't return the land in a way is better than they found it. Common methods would be like digging and hauling it away. But being able to utilize phytoremediation, we are generally planting trees that are inoculated with microbes that break down contamination, but we leave a community with like an established park, forest, whatever the client wants to do with it. But many times it's returned back to the community in terms of a park.
So do the trees not do this remediation without the inoculant?
They do do it, but we're using microbes that have been, trying to simplify this, that have been isolated from areas where these microbes have developed these specialized abilities to break down contamination. So, you know, if you could imagine, I like sort of relate it to taking a probiotic where you're just increasing the natural bacteria that already exists, but just putting more in there. So you can fight off phytotoxicity. So it's that sort of idea. We're giving the trees a better ability to deal with contamination and break down contamination faster, and a number of many other benefits, which is why it helps them establish better in like degraded lands. If we're wanting to reforest an area, we'll get better establishment if we use the inoculant, if we just spray it on their roots. And it's really just the symbiotic relationship between the roots and the plants. The microbes are there to live inside the plant, which is why we call it an endophyte, endo meaning in, phyte meaning plant. We're not doing anything to it. It's not genetically modified. We're just increasing the dose.
So in ways, is that like someone inoculating their soil with mycorrhizae fungi for their roots?
Well, we do that as well, but I would say that would be a good way of thinking about it. Right. Although the mycorrhizae lives on the outside, this endophyte lives on the inside.
So now these endophytes, they actually break down the contaminants, and it's not just the tree absorbing and banking the contaminants.
So it depends on the contamination. Okay. And I think the easiest division to think about is organic versus inorganic. Organic contaminants will be broken down within the root system, so the roots and up through some portion of the trunk of the tree, where inorganic contaminants, plants just take them up. So we do something a little different. If you could just imagine farming. If you were to grow something like a grass, that a brassica, mustards, those types of things, we'll take up the metals. Then we'd have to remove them and dispose of them and grow it again, remove them and dispose of them. So that's how we would deal with matter.
So essentially metals. That plant material is in some sense toxic then.
It has absorbed them.
Disposed of.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it, again, it depends on the contaminant. It depends on the site, where the depth of groundwater is or where the contaminant is. And we design a system to treat whatever it is we're looking at.
When you say you design a system, that would be a battery of different types of plants that would be utilized in that place that you're trying to do it?
Sure.
Like, and this type of tree, this type of...
Right. If we're dealing with groundwater, we'd want to put in like a hybrid poplar tree that's maybe bred to be specific to breaking down boron salt or more tolerant, more tolerant to salt and boron. So if we know the site has that, we'll plant a hybrid poplar. Again, we have clients coming to us that still would want us to use natives. So natives are generally in California, they're not thirsty, right? Because that's not the temperament that they're trying to acclimate to. So what we could do is plant our hybrid poplar trees to treat the contamination, plant natives around it on a different irrigation system so that when the hybrid poplars die out after 30 years, because that's their lifespan, they will not become invasive because they're sterile and they're male. Then you have this understory, the successionary planting of the natives that ultimately can restore the area while giving nature a little bit help. Using what nature already does, just giving a little bit more help there. And we're really doing a great thing for the environment. So I think that's where the passion really comes from, is being able to use those new skills, but marry them with the native skills. Continually push people to think outside the box and really remember what they loved about science and geology and why they got into the field and how they really can, with us together, engineer a better system.
This sounds like a process that would be, and maybe it is being used, probably more so back east. in reclamation of areas that have been strip mined.
Absolutely.
Because typically if you're mining something, the stuff that you're digging out of the ground probably is not all that great. And the tailings and the things that are left over are not as nice as just good leftover soil.
Yeah.
So it's going to take a different process to reforest or rejuvenate those areas.
You're going to need some help there for sure. And I'm glad you brought that up because I have had the opportunity to travel quite extensively into South Africa as well for different conferences and a few international TED Talks. But one of their big issues that they are dealing with, unusually all the same issues we're dealing with. They have drought. They're trying to establish more tree canopy in their cities. Agriculture degrading the land from using excess synthetic fertilizers for so many decades, which is why teaching people more organic and regenerative ways of gardening is so important. But in addition to that, there is a lot of mining going on there. I mean, if we are driving our electric vehicles and we are becoming very green and clean out here, guess who's taking the brunt of those minerals that we need? It's other countries. We just don't see it. So that did open my eyes to when we talk about being green and using EV and solar powered, those minerals come from somewhere. And they're coming from Africa. So, they have a big push to require mines to have to revegetate when they are done. That is part of the whole program there. And I imagine we'll be following suit here in the U.S. I hope we continue to be utilizing the EPA and not stripping that back. But it's been incredibly valuable to see the problems all over the world. And we're all in this world together and we all have the same problems together. So how do we fight those problems? And, you know, a big part of the shrinking biodiversity is the fact that we're not planting enough natives. We're overdeveloping and then putting in, you know, our big box store specials and people not knowing any better that by not putting native plants back in there, all that diversity that used to be there dies off or goes somewhere else. So one of the simplest, easiest ways to kind of give back to the environment is just to plant native landscaping and get educated on it and understand that you'd be providing a benefit in helping to increase biodiversity.
I think a lot of people that have been transplanted here, when they think of natives, they think of, you know, the dry chaparral. Yeah. And a boring, you know, plant that's dead looking half the year.
Yeah.
And Ken, you've said this numerous times that Moosa Creek in particular, but other nurseries have brought in so much plant material that are natives, but they look much, much better than a simple grayish leaf thing on a hill somewhere. There's a lot more color and textures and flavors of them.
Yeah. I think the first time that I remember there being a big push for, at least in my experience in my career, the first time that we saw a big push towards natives and drought tolerant plants was in the drought of around 1991. Mm-hmm. And there was a huge shift away from the tropical and subtropical stuff that was our staple for many, many years, but there weren't very many people growing native plants or drought tolerant plants or, Australia, a lot of Australian plants had not been introduced yet, and a lot of South African plants had not been introduced yet.
Other than eucalyptus.
Other than eucalyptus and grevilleas.
Right.
The grevillea robusta. That was the only grevillea that you could get at that time. Or maybe Hakea folia. That might have still been available. But that has changed over time. And I think with the drought cycle that we have, I think people obviously must have realized that natives will help with that situation. And Moosa Creek was, as far as I'm concerned, the first nursery that really did a fantastic job.
Hank and Sue Krauss.
They did a tremendous job for that segment of the market. And I was never early in my career, I was never a big fan of native plants, but over the past decade or so, I think they're fantastic. They're There's some really, really beautiful native plants out there.
And the sheer variety.
And the variety. All you have to do is go to Moosa Creek's website and look at the catalog of stuff that they grow. Mm-hmm. It's mind-boggling.
Right.
It's crazy how much stuff they grow. It used to be that there was one or two ceanothus that were commonly available. Now you go to their website, I don't even know how many they are.
15 buckwheats, 15 mm-hmm. ceanothus. I'll tell you, moving to the Bay Area, there's a couple of really amazing examples of native landscaping in the north. And keep in mind, so I was working at Moosa for a short period of time, and I always saw the natives in the one-gallon plants. And, you know, they don't look that great in one-gallon plants. Right, you mm-hmm. you got to put them in the ground, and let them do their thing. But truly, it's like the third year that they're spectacular. But when I relocated to the Bay Area, there's quite a few corporate campuses that have planted only native, and so there's a Microsoft campus in Mountain View and a Google campus in Mountain View, and an amazing nature trail that I would walk by my home, and I was just like, oh my God, these native plants are so beautiful. But they were established and they were in their communities and they really are incredible. And for corporate landscaping, they can irrigate a little bit more. And I don't say irrigate more than they're already irrigating. It's less than they would normally be irrigating. But if they maintain irrigation through certain parts of the year, they can help with that portion of time that the natives just want to get dried out. You know,
You know, I'll have to go up and take a look at that next time I go see my son at Stanford and check out some of those things. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We're going to take a quick break and we're getting back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We're talking to our special guest, plant scientist Renee Murphy. And we've been talking about phytoremediation. We've been talking about native plants. And you were mentioning just a couple of places up in Northern California in the Bay Area to go and take a look at. The Google campus was one that you mentioned, and also the Microsoft campus. I was telling you during the break that when we were up there in October, we actually did go over to the Google Carousel building, that's worth going to see just in itself. It is an absolutely mind-bogglingly spectacular building, but we walked all the way around it and it's a huge building. But the landscaping there was tremendous. It was really, really well done, just beautifully landscaped all the way around with natives. And the tree that I remember that they had tons of them, and you just don't see them down here, was California buckeyes.
Yes, oh my gosh.
They had all kinds of them in the landscape up there.
I just saw one somewhere recently, in the last week.
Down here?
Yeah, it was for sale somewhere. I'm trying to remember where I saw it.
Aeschylus californica.
Yes.
Yeah. They'll express themselves differently too. You know, being here that it's hotter and drier, and up there they get more water. So you will see quite a variety in how they express themselves. So I think that's why it sort of was my Disneyland going up there, was just going from the 1 gallon size to seeing everything in full landscape.
Right.
And I think if everybody saw that for natives, they would change this idea that we have of natives. And what I try and educate people about is, like, you're coming from somewhere else, East Coast. You can't come to California and expect to landscape your yard like you did on the East Coast.
No.
Right? I see every time I go to Arizona, I just am so saddened by how many people continue to put fake turf in as their grass, and they're not even understanding they're heating plastic up in their front yard and killing.
None of us like that.
All biodiversity. Yeah. I'm glad, because some people hear that for the, like, they don't even think about that they're just heating plastic up every day. But if you understood that when natives during the summer, they're going into sort of a dormancy period of survival. So they're not expressing energy in flowers. And there are plants that do. But I think people have this idea when they see our dry hillsides and they think, oh, natives don't look good. No, those natives are surviving during the hottest part of the summer, but they might look absolutely beautiful in the winter. Where on the East Coast, you know, everything is dormant because of the cold. So I think it's just not understanding the science behind why a plant looks the way it does during the time of year that it does. And if we learned that, I think we'd appreciate that more. If we could re-educate our homeowners associations when they see a native landscape as being weedy, there's an intention behind that by leaving plants in that kind of weedy appearance that we would normally trim that back so that it looks clean. We want to keep that through the winter and into the early spring because we're actually providing homes for insects and food for all of those little animals that have nothing to eat during the wintertime. You are actually removing those opportunities and you're removing the homes for those pollinators. We think of pollinators, first thing that comes to mind is the honeybee. That's not native. Our native bees are solitary and they live in plants and in the ground and in the soil and burrow in holes. So we have to be careful about how we maintain our landscaping and understand that we could be removing those homes and that there are different times of what we've been taught in standard gardening classes that we need to actually landscape a little bit differently. So like I would recommend always, you know, you think the best time to plant is in the spring. That's when all the nurseries are showing the flowers. But I would actually argue with that, say the best time to plant is in the fall if you're looking to plant natives. If you put them into the ground, you're giving them a good period of time where it's cool. They can establish a good hardy root system. And then come spring, they can explode with new growth. And additionally, the benefit is that we're saving money on water. Now, mm-hmm. I'm not saying you can't plant natives throughout the year. You do, and I have. But the easiest and the best start you can give to a native plant is by starting it in the fall when you're transplanting it. And I always prefer a 1 gallon size. unless you do, you know, you're looking to do some sort of, you need one showpiece in the middle. But typically your 5 gallon and your 1 gallon will catch up to that 5 gallon. They have done studies on this. And although it's nice to have bigger to start, those 1 gallons will catch up in time. But when it comes to irrigating for natives, there is a different way to do it. And I would recommend to everybody to research Greg Rubin. He's a local San Diego expert and my mentor. He's taught me so much of how I teach and understanding. And interesting that he comes from an aeroscience background again. Working with NASA and so we connect on so many levels, but we're not looking at things holistically and we need to look at all the different pieces of the puzzle and how those all fit together. And the most important thing to remember is that we always want to mimic what nature does. So if you can think about anything like what does nature do here? When does nature water this plant? When is the best time? When do I see this plant express itself in different ways? And when you can understand that, you will truly become the best gardener that you can be and really understand that we are part of this holistic, circular, this sustainability circle and that everything we do affects something else. And if you just study your garden, you'll see nature does that. Everything she does is for a reason. Your trees drop leaves onto the ground that turns into mulch and fertilizer, provides homes for the insects. And in the spring, your tree comes back. So everything is circular.
She just repeated Chuck McClung, who teaches our orchid classes and a couple other classes, his book on how to get orchids to rebloom. And his philosophy has always been, if you can mimic the characteristics of where this plant was grown, you will be successful with it, which is what she just said, you know.
Which is that, yeah, you know,
you just have to mimic this, whether it's a tropical plant, whatever. You want to make it grow, you have to make it live like where it grew up, where it's from.
Well, when you boil it down, that's basically what horticulture is.
Absolutely.
And when you bring in non-native plants, you have to try to treat them like they would be in their native habitat. Otherwise, you're not going to be successful with it. And so that I would say that's a basic tenet of horticulture, yeah, is mimicking the environment that they're in.
If you think about, like, everybody knows what the soil looks like on an orchid, right? It's like that chunky bark, right? What if you planted an orchid in a very heavy forest type soil? Like, how would that affect that orchid? You know, and when I teach my classes, I think about that. I'm like, if you're planting a cactus, what does that soil look like in the desert? Do you need to have something that's more porous and more sand? Just think about where that plant comes from. And that's going to give you a big clue as to how you're going to treat it, how you're going to water it. But I think all of us, we bring those houseplants home and we wonder, why did that houseplant just die? Well, have you seen a nursery setting for how they grow houseplants? I mean, they're incredibly humid, perfect environments. And then you bring it home, your house that's dry without humidity, and we wonder why they struggle. So if we just, and I was a terrible gardener before. I loved gardening, but I was terrible at it before I went to school. And just learning those basics and what nature provides will just make you such a better gardener. Right.
Without a doubt. I don't know if we have time in this segment, but I would like, if you have the time or the inclination, to tell us about some plants that we can, native plants that we could put in that will give us summer green, because most people's, you know, they barbecue, they're outside in the summer in their yards a lot more than in the rainy winters when everything is starting to come back to life. What are plants that we can plant native wise that will look good in the summer?
So I would say there, and I don't know why I'm forgetting that off the top of my head. Think about the hummingbird, and it has that red tubular flower. It's epilobium. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Epilobium canum, I believe, is the botanical name. It is, I would say it would be the first plant I would get because it's one of the few summer bloomers. It puts off a beautiful red tubular flower that the hummingbirds will come to your yard, come crazy for this plant. You see people with hummingbird feeders and you're like, you don't need that. You need to provide them food and they'll come to your garden. So I would say that would be the first plant if you're trying to get a summer bloom. And if you also study Calscape and see what's in your area, but also Moosa Creek's website, the way I would go about designing the yard is staging the plants and making sure I have different plants representing different times of which they bloom, so that you have a continuous expression of flowers.
Palette, if you will.
Absolutely. And you know, we see on the hillsides, like in San Diego, a lot of the freeway, the sides of the freeway, you'll see the ceanothus. So again, understanding, using Calscape and understanding what's going to grow really well in your particular climate, and then also looking at the microclimate, because there's a lot of microclimates here in San Diego. But understanding what already wants to be here is going to just really help your garden look much better if you're putting something that already just likes the conditions here. So I would say ceanothus is a great shrub plant. I love the toyon because it's one of the few plants that puts off a beautiful red berry during Christmas time. Mm-hmm. And there's food for the birds during that time of year. So that's one of my favorites. I love manzanita because, again, manzanita will bloom through like December, January-ish, which you don't get that much with different flowers. So you really have to study the needs of your yard first. Like, don't go out and just buy a plant for the sake of buying that plant. You want to understand that you're putting the right plant in the right place, right? We don't want to put something that has or that's going to get very big and put that right next to our home. Like, we have to think about what does my yard look like? What kind of light is my yard getting? What kind of watering do I have access to? And what do I need in that area? And then figure out what grows well in your area and then go to the nursery. don't go to the nursery blind and just pick whatever you see up off the shelf. I mean, it's so hard not to do that. I still want to do that. You know,
you're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We're going to take a quick break and we're going to be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements and our special guest, plant scientist Renee Murphy. We were talking a little bit about planting natives, and fall is the best time to plant them. For many, many years, the California Association of Nurserymen, which evolved into the California Association of Nurseries and Garden Centers, pushed fall as for planting. But I think it was the transplanted East Coast mindset just never...
I'm sitting right here. I can hear you.
Never overcame the springtime planting. And even today, spring is our busiest season, and there is a lot more that you can do in the springtime than you can in the fall. But fall is a fantastic time to plant native, not just natives, but a lot of different stuff can go in at that time. And then we had also touched on being successful in horticulture is being able to mimic the growing conditions of the different plants that you bring in, and that's one of the reasons why South African plants and Australian plants do so well over here, is because our climate does mimic those particular areas where they're bringing those plants from over in South Africa and Australia.
Yeah, and those plants are spectacular. I'm not going to lie. The first time I took a hike, I was like, oh, these are all those plants that, you know, we all know. All the plants that we see planted in landscaping out here, and really realizing that we have very little native California landscaping here. Even when you go to like city buildings, beautiful historical buildings, you'd think that they'd want to maintain the, you know, historical nature of California there. And you'll still see plants that come from all over the world with that building. I think we should make it really cool just to have everything be California. Right, everything should have California vibes.
That's
going to
be hard with
vibes.
All my fruit trees. Not going to happen.
Well, but now here's the thing. I mean, let's take agriculture out of this.
Okay.
We all need right. to eat.
No, I'm not talking out there. I'm talking my yard. I have a lot of fruit trees, and so I gotta maintain those.
You know what? There's nothing wrong with that because we need to eat.
All right.
But what I always tell people is, you're going to have areas that you need to water because you want to eat, and the other areas you don't really have to water if you put in native landscaping, right? So it's kind of like a give and a take.
Gives you more water for the fruit trees.
Yes, there absolutely. We go. You got to balance that water bill here in California.
That is true. And it's just going to keep getting worse for the foreseeable future too, unfortunately. Speaking of the South African plants, what are some of your favorites that you've seen that have been introduced over here now?
Well, the first one that comes to mind is the Bird of Paradise. That's pretty spectacular. If I showed you my camera roll, you would die. These are just like what I'm seeing hiking. And because I'm not an expert on South African plants, I probably couldn't even give you three examples. I'd have to show you pictures. But so much of just the typical landscaping you'd see all over California is just... it's
natal plums. South Africa.
I like
that one. Yeah.
Proteus.
Those trees that look like they're aloe at the top, and then down near the bottom, it looks kind of like an elephant.
Oh, it could be a tree aloe.
Have you seen those? Like, yeah, the tree aloe.
It could be a tree aloe. Yeah. Aloe arborensis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And have you seen the aloe that have, they kind of have spots? They're kind of like little kind of spikes growing out of them. I'm not even using the right term, but... those are South African, and you'll see those all over when you're going on safaris. You'll see these plants and you're like, oh God, you know, we have those all over California. That's how they've been brought over for decades. And I get it. They're spectacular. But, you know, there are plants here in California that are being poached and taken like over to China, like our Dudleus.
Dudleus, yeah.
Right? Dope. Stolen from the wild. Mm-hmm. Yep. And they don't grow from seed. So, or I'm sorry, they grow from seed rather than like your typical succulent. So, you know, they're taken from the wild all the time. They're not easily propagated. Maybe there wouldn't be such a big issue if they propagated like succulents did, where you could just take a piece, stick it in the soil and get a new plant. You can't do it. You have to grow it from seed, and they grow very slowly. But yeah, I would imagine that we just want what we don't have, you know, kind of like a girl growing up. She always wants, she wants curly hair if her hair's straight, if her hair's curly, you know? So it's really that education of understanding why we should love what we have, and what was provided to us by nature, and give the best showing of that. I think that's where we can truly be happy.
Now you did you've done a couple of TED Talks, I believe, over in South Africa.
I have, maybe,
So tell us about the one that you did for the University of Johannesburg.
Yeah, that was quite an incredible experience. Number one, getting there. My flight was delayed for 3 days, and those were the 3 days that I was going to have to not be jet lagged. So that didn't work out. But if anybody who knows South Africans will tell you this is true, they downplay their excellence. So when I was speaking to the woman who was curating the talk, she's like, no, it's not a very big deal. It's, you know, just, it's the university and, you know, it's students you'll be talking to, which automatically that I wanted to be there because I wanted to talk to those students. And the university sponsors the event, which normally you would be selling tickets, but they sponsor the event. And when I showed up, I didn't realize that we would be in a two-tiered auditorium with 600 people, and I felt like I was on the show The Voice. The production quality was incredible. The support the university had for this event that they do annually, it was so professional. It was like a big fair out front with band and food, and the whole event was catered. I mean, we felt like celebrities. It was just incredible, but it was not what I expected. I thought this would just be your normal academia type event. And it was incredible. But what I was able to speak on sustainability. So if you just Google TED Talk, Renee Murphy, sustainability, it'll come up. But I was able to give a shout out to Walter Anderson's because, again, the story, this impactful story to me about Maya was that when I came back to teach, there weren't, I usually draw a bigger crowd. And this particular time, I didn't get that same crowd. And I kind of changed concepts.
I think it was the title. We talked about
Gardening More Sustainably. Right. And so I was like, well, that's, you know, my ego's a little bruised. But I remembered that it's not about the number. It's touching that one person. And when I reinforced that in myself, like, look, it's not about that. Just go out there and do what you do. And I looked out in the audience and I saw Maya and her parents. And her parents had come to tell me how Maya had just become this amazing whirlwind. She was educating her troop. She was educating at school. She was teaching.
I'm going to add to that, not to cut you off, but she stood out here and did, Maya has come to this nursery on Saturdays and stood in front of the native plant section with placards explaining native plants as for her Girl Scout badge, whatever we call them, Girl Scouts. Mm-hmm. And she was doing that here because of you. So she was here teaching people about native plants.
So it truly is touching that one person. It's like throwing that little pebble into, you know, the pond and watching the ripple effect. And I'll never truly know the ripples that Maya is going to, all the effects she's going to have, all the good she's going to do for the environment. And it's like, I did that, you know, with just that one person. And that's why I do what I do.
That is really cool. That is very admirable.
And, you know, people always ask me, they're like, how can I help? And I'm like, go teach the kids, because the kids then teach the parents. It's hard to get us older people to change. But if you educate the youth, they will go out and take care of business. It's their world, and I'm struggling for what we've left for them. But they have to take charge. And the more we could teach them about these principles of sustainability and taking care of their environment, they will continue to hopefully propagate that through the rest of the world. You like that pun?
I see what you did
there.
You like
that pun? Yeah. You like?
When the South Africa talk you had met at Johannesburg, you said was a big event, like bands and such. What was it? The entire day was on sustainability with different speakers?
It wasn't on sustainability. I'm forgetting what the overall overarching theme. Interconnectedness.
Okay. Mm.
So when you speak at a TED talk, there's usually about 10 to 12 speakers, and whatever you're speaking about falls under this theme of interconnectedness. So it's not necessarily about sustainability. Okay. But I will tell you, they read my talk. They selected me based on the science talk. And when they read the talk, they said, this is too much science. I was like, what? Because I thought I speak pretty simply about science. But they said, no, this is too much. But we know there's something else that's in your heart that you need to speak about. And they were right, because I didn't talk about sustainability, and I didn't talk about these things that inspired me to do what I did. And that's what the story they wanted to hear. So they needed to hear about Maya. So I don't know if Maya even knows that.
Well, I know her mother. So when I see her next time, I will tell her all about that. Absolutely.
I need to email her and let her know.
Yep.
Is there a way, if somebody would like to get more information from you, is there a way that they can contact you?
Yes, you can contact me over LinkedIn, Renee Murphy. If you're on Instagram or TikTok, you can find me on @midlifefarmgirl, all one word.
We'll put that up on the Facebook page too, we'll so that people can reach out. So, Renee, thank you very much for coming in. This has been a very enjoyable hour talking to you about everything that you're doing and the path that brought you to it. And we really appreciate you taking the time to come in and talk with us and our audience.
Thank you for having me, and know what a big contribution you've made into my beautiful environmental life.
We're happy to help. You've been listening to The Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We're going to be back next week with another hour of Garden Talk. If you'd like to reach out and get in touch with us, you can email us at gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, independent and family-owned since 1928. For more information about plants, products, expert advice, news, classes, podcasts, and more, visit walteranderson.com.